I also want to welcome Adam Rothenberg to the stage. We're going to have a little chat. He has this incredible podcast I love called Call Me Adam. And so, welcome. I'm excited to introduce my good friend, Adam Rothenberg. I'm not just sure where he is. There he is! Right there. Okay, cool. Awesome. Can we give a big round? Number one, let's give a big round of applause for Megan Hill, who's in the play. We must applaud. Oh, right. Oh my God! Oh my God, acting! But you disappeared and then you reappeared. That was amazing. And we give a big round of applause for Adam Rothenberg, who's about to come on stage right now. Here he comes. Now, I have to tell you about Adam, I don't know when we started interviewing people, okay? But apparently it was 16 years ago. But look, I mean, Adam, were you 10? Adam was 10 and started interviewing people. And he's been going behind the scenes, interviewing artists and celebrities from the world of film, television, theater, music. I encourage you, Adam will walk you through his platforms. You have to hear some of his interviews. They're truly extraordinary. And he has a collected book that you can purchase that's in the lobby, and it's really extraordinary. And these interviews are 2,200 of them. Adam just released his debut book, which is out there, Behind the Curtain, The Mistakes, Lessons Learned, and Triumphs Interviewing Celebrities, which means, Megan, that we're celebrities. Yes. where he shares lessons learned that altered the way he conducted interviews to relationships that were strengthened, strained, and ruined to fun stories about interviewing his entertainment idols. Please note that tonight's talkback will be recorded, so shield your face. Find a little hat if you don't want to be seen, or you can step outside if you like. If you talk, you will be heard if you have a question. And so without further ado, Alakazam and Alakazoo, let's welcome Adam Rothenberg!
Thank you. Thank you for that great introduction, Crystal. And thank you, everybody, for staying to the talk back and coming to see Open tonight. We're very excited to have you here. And we are so excited to be featuring playwright herself, Crystal Skillman, and Open star, Megan Hill. So, are you ready for some fun?
Lay it on.
We don't know the questions, just so you know.
All right, well, we're gonna start off easy, and then we'll get into it. So, Crystal, I wanna start with you. First question is, where did you come up with the idea to write Open?
Well, I've written a play called Wild that was done downtown on Christopher Street at IRT in 2014, and it featured the relationship of Peter and Bobby and this committed relationship. And I was in the lobby and I heard someone say, "That's so great, Crystal wrote this couple like they were a normal couple." And that really bothered me for obvious reasons. And it was percolating my mind, and I didn't know quite what to do with it. And then I worked on a short piece that was involving with saving a partner. And while I was developing the piece, I realized how I had it was very short. And I realized, and it was a magician trying to do this, and I realized it could be a female magician. And once I had kind of hold of that idea, and I kind of saw the magician on stage, started writing the story, which kind of felt like it was channeled to me at the time, 2014, 2015, 2016, I think you can see where I'm going, of what we were kind of surrounded by, that I was responding to. Around the time I was developing that work, this was close to the time that I had worked on a play called Cut with Megan Hill. And I immediately had Megan in mind and Jesse D. Hill, the director, and we really have been developing it all those years. And then we did some workshops, and then we had the opportunity for a production in 2019, and that's how Open was really born. And throughout the whole process, you know, I was consistently like with this metaphor of really trusting the audience and having them see the magic to be with what the magician is sharing with us in the story, the love of Jenny. There were these moments, especially before I knew it could work, where I'd be like, I don't know, maybe we do see the magic. Maybe there's some flowers. Maybe we just throw in some flowers. And Jesse D. Hill, the director, would just say, "Crystal, if this is the metaphor," I'm like, "Oh, I'm so scared." And so it was really a delight in 2019 when we really saw the audience lean in. We really saw them see the things that we saw. We saw them try to hold the bird. We saw the birth of the bird. Those things that we got very excited about what the piece could be.
So Megan, I wasn't really gonna ask you, why did you want to audition for the show? But since Crystal wrote it for what do you love about performing the
audition
show?
Audition now. This was the audition.
Exactly. So why do you love performing the show? Because you did it in 2019, now you're doing it again.
I mean, even from the moment I love working with Crystal. Even when we started working on in the very, very beginning of working on the script, where we literally meet in our apartments and go through the text, and Crystal is someone who's like really brilliant about, like, she gets it all out of her system. So I think like the first draft.
We call it a vomit draft.
Yeah, but then she's not sacred about anything. So we read this draft that was like 60 some odd pages, and then we ordered in food, and then for like 3 hours, we were just like, we don't need this, or this would be better here. And like so just kind of being with the script really from the ground floor up, and Crystal and Jesse are just incredible collaborators, where it just feels like we were all operating on all cylinders, where I got to use my dramaturgical mind and my playwright mind and my actor mind. And then like Crystal just goes back and it's like, I always call her a champion and a warrior. And then for the story, it's, I think the thing that's been striking me, because I think it was like 2012 or 13 that we first started like work. So it's been a hot minute.
I don't know time very well.
Yeah. It's been a hot minute that we've been developing this script and figuring out what works, what doesn't. We always knew what it wasn't, and we just kept digging until we found what it was. But I think the hardest thing has been there were different pockets in that time, especially earlier on, and then also from like theater companies being like, well, is this really relevant? Like, is this really, like, especially in New York, does this kind of thing really happen? And it's sadly, I keep waiting for this piece to be a museum piece, and instead it just feels like it keeps becoming more and more evergreen, which is incredibly upsetting. But I think just also the way it deals with grief, and then it ends on this note of how we move forward in life with grief. It's just a powerful message, and I can't read the script without crying. I just feel so inside of it, but it's a very interesting process to be a part do every night, but because of where it ends, I just kind of feel like I can leave everything on stage, and then also just commune with the audience in such a way. It's really a privilege and a gift.
Well, that actually leads into one of my next questions for you. So how do you prepare for this journey every night? You know, you have your own life that you're coming from. How do you leave your life out there and get into that train of thought?
Yeah, how do you do that?
For every show I do, I always have like different little rituals. Well, for this one, I eat a big chunk of challah before I go on stage. Just to make sure, like, my energy level's gonna be good, it's tasty, so I chug a lot of water. It's a lot of, like, especially with a piece like this, a friend of mine says acting, it's not about staying in it the whole time, like, that's actually impossible, and if you're doing method, then it's like, you're insane. But she's a director, she's a brilliant director, and she says it's about disconnecting and reconnecting. Like, there's always gonna be something that like pops you out for a second. There's gonna be stuff happening in your body that you're like, whoa, that's weird, or you know, and then on top of just being in the story and imagining all of the things and telling the story. So for this one, it's interesting because the thing that's been actually the biggest gift and that is really my prep for it, like I do vocal warm-up and physical warm-up and stuff like that, but the thing like is being on stage when the audience gets here, which when Crystal and Jesse were like, so we want you on the stage when the audience walks in, me, Megan, as the performer, was like, no, that just goes against, I was like, oh God, because I think I was afraid I'd be like spiraling out or feeling my nerves, and it's just been a complete gift because it feels like an active meditation, and I'm listening to everybody, and I pretend like I'm conducting the audience. or show up at Marie's crisis. So know Kristen and all of her flaws, and know Jenny, and so then also feels intimate. And that's been actually, and that's been a revelation in the performance of it. And actually, my partner was telling me, I came home because we had like one show where it was like a quiet audience. It was the first time I felt like the audience was skeptical. Like when I looked out there, kind of like. And my partner was like, "Well, you imagine them." And I was like, "Oh." Kristen imagines the audience, so why did you imagine that particular audience? And so then all of a sudden that's been revelatory for me, where I'm just like, when I open my eyes, I'm like, oh, these are the people I've imagined. And it's been cool. That answers it.
Yes. And I love the follow-up. So, Crystal, why was it important for you to weave magic throughout the story to help move the story along, as opposed to just tell the story?
Yeah. All of my work, if you look at it, we don't really know when I talk about this in theater, but in the comic book world, we talk about it a lot, and I live a little bit in that world too. My work always uses genre and the structure of genre to tell each story. And so when I realized that when I go back to that conversation I overheard, I see something that's very clear to me, that love is love, and the love of a soul in any form, in all forms, is exciting and wonderful. That's why we're here. And it felt like the conversation I was overhearing was people didn't see that. And I thought, well, theater's about making you see things that aren't there. You know, I often say to my students, you know, it's all symbols, you know? So, you know,
hello.
You know, that can be in a play. Like, oh, she's talking on the phone. But like, if it was in a movie and I was like, hello, I'd be like, wow, they had no budget. So it's symbolic, it has, and we can see each other. So I love, and I always, in every piece of other people's too, I like to watch the audience just as much as I love to watch the show itself. And I thought, this is a show, because a lot of people say solo show, but this is really a one-person play, and the play is between Kristen and the audience. So they're the other characters. There's so many each night, you know?
Yeah,
you know, it depends. It's all different. And so I thought that metaphor was so beautiful for magic. And then as I began to develop it, I realized that magic has such misdirection in storytelling to avoid what's going on. And that is often used as a metaphor for grief in different ways. And I thought, that's so powerful, I want to keep developing that.
Well, speaking of the audience, first of all, did anybody here tonight, were you a recipient of any of her magical things that happened at the beginning of the show?
Wonderful.
So why was it important to you to write that audience interaction into the show?
There's, I think just recognizing the audience and looking at people, right, is such a powerful thing. But we got very excited when in the beginning of the show, you're at, before even the moment with my mom now, the balls and asking to catch. And Megan, do you remember exactly how we developed that? Because that was pretty exciting, because we realized if you were reaching your hand out and there's a sound, you're surprised, and then you're like, oh my gosh, I have the ball. Now we have you, right? And do you remember how we developed that?
I think it was, so during the 2019 production, I think we had like 3 weeks of rehearsal. And because it was the first time we were really getting stuff on our feet, it was like really the first 2 weeks of rehearsal, we're figuring out what the thing was. And that's when we were really playing, like, is it shadow puppetry? Is it projection? Is it this? And we just kept pulling it away. And we had chairs on stage, and we had tables, and we kept pulling them away. And we had scrims, and we kept pulling them away. And then Jesse was like, we need to have our sound designer in here, because what if it is just sound, and then certain the way the light hits? And so I think Emma, but I think that one we didn't come up with until I think tech.
Wow.
Of where it was like, oh, and it should, like, because we just kept mining of being like, okay, well, what would we, or even when we realized it was sounds and Emma would start coming in, we'd be like, what would make a sound? Okay, the scarf coming out. Okay, the flowers. If we put the flowers back in. And then also the theatricality of it too. Of like, there are some sounds where it's like, in real life, you probably wouldn't hear like the sound of the cards that loud. But for the theatricality of it and the motion, like, let's hear it. And then it's like, okay, well, if we have the balls, like, what if we hear where the audience catches it? And we did have, like, we've had performances where people, like, look back to see. And so that's just, and I think just trying to find also those moments of delight, because I think that is a moment of delight, at least for me.
I want to add, when we did this for teenagers and then from the Italian tour, I'd never seen it before. That there was, they were so willing, and they all kept reaching for the ball. So there wasn't enough balls.
It was amazing, because they're like,
all right. Well, I do want everybody here to also start thinking of questions, because I'm going to open it up in a few moments to audience questions if you have. No pressure. But I have at least two more questions. So first one is, has there ever been a time when you have wished magic could have helped you out of a situation, or if it could have helped you enhance a situation? And you have to say what that situation was. You can't just say yes or no.
I mean, this is a silly one, but off the top of my head, whenever I'm caught in traffic, I like to imagine if I did this with the steering wheel, I would like levitate my car up and over everything. And then I'm sure there are like serious points in my life where I'm like, oh, I wish I could, you know, I think there's probably many points where I wish I could turn back time or replay something. Or cloak of invisibility.
Love invisibility.
I think ever since being a kid, I think it's because I was bullied a lot as a kid. And it comes up a lot in my work. You'll hear about the wishing to disappear. But it's not that you don't exist. It's just that for one moment, you know, you can just be in a way. It's almost like, and so I think a lot of open eyes. Working that out. I would say that I do something when I go down the street. I call it, I took it from a short story my friend wrote, called avenue surfing. So I try to make my body so I can move between the bodies. It's like a fun little game. But I really wish I had a superpower that I could just, I love that thing where you click, like Magneto, you know, like you could just like control metal or things to like push people in certain ways and like not hurt them, but just kind of, you know, help guide them to go. Or maybe, I guess, if I'm really gonna friend people with it, pretend it's a city and I really wish I could make people walk faster, probably.
Okay, so you just brought up a question. With the bullying that you endured, how much did that influence writing the scene where Jenny gets beat up?
Well, she heavily beaten as a hate crime, so she ends up in the hospital, so very beaten. I was always trying to avoid beating up. It was like sometimes got close, you know, I would just kind of find a way out of it. What was the direct question again?
How much of your personal experience with bullying mm-hmm. influenced that part?
I think the part of the story that is also a very deep part of my origin story involves my mom, which is right here. So I tell this often, that don't think I'd be who I am. And I think there's a lot in this play about communication. There's a lot about how Kristen wants so badly to communicate, and it's so hard to show who she is. And I think her lesson with Jenny, like her whole experience, is not to retreat out of fear, but to be who you are, and the fear will go away. There is no fear. And when I was being bullied, and the worst was so in most cases I could escape, right? Because I could walk faster. But in the school bus, it's like a moving prison and you can't leave. So one day I came home and they said, well, I'm not going to school anymore. It's just not working out. And mom was like, what? I was like 12 and she's like, what happened? And I was like, well, you know, it's bullying going on. I don't really want to go into it. And my mom was like, what did, she's like, going on, what happened? And I go, look, if you want me to go to school, that's cool, but you're gonna have to drive me every day. And she was like, drive you every day? I will. And I didn't expect that. And I felt like I was heard, and just something went off in my head. And I said, even though it's hard to do, I might not find the right person right away. So I'm sure I talked to other people about the situation. But I was like, if I can find the right person, if I keep talking and I don't get shy enough, I'm gonna find someone to help me, and it's gonna work out, and we can solve the problem.
And then, of course, my mom had to listen for 4 years because I think this was middle school. So I guess I got my license like 4 or 5 years. She had to listen to Into the Woods every day. Whole album.
That's an awesome mom. So, this one's also for both of you. If you could cast this spell in your own life, what would you want it to do for you?
You've got so many.
No, I
wish!
I like having like little touchstones and stuff. And so I have like my own little spells that I like, just little mantras. Like I was going through a really difficult time once, and you know, making theater is hard. And I was like, oh, is this gonna be the thing that like breaks my heart in a way that it like it's gonna harden me, and I don't want to be hardened. So I was like, okay, what are the things you need to be an artist to like keep going through and getting up every day? And I was like, okay, you need to have heart, you need to have guts, you need to not lose your sense of humor, and fortitude and resiliency. And they're five, and so five makes a fist, packs a punch. And so then that became like a thing. Like I was like, oh, I would just be like, heart, guts, humor, fortitude, resiliency. Like, so that's what a spell, I guess. Oh, I mean, it's like, it's a spell. Oh, it's not a direct spell, but I think it's in the play, so I might just be kind of reiterating what you saw. I really have a trouble with loss, but I also feel like the people that I've lost are around me, and I've always felt that way. And so there was a book, you might know, it got me into a cool musical too, called Tuck Everlasting. So it's not really a direct spell, it's more like a potion, but I love that they had the power from this like kind of little well from this tree. They had this special water that if you drank it, you would live forever. So I don't know if I directly want to live forever, but I just love that they gave it to other people or wanted that for other people as well.
All right, so does anybody in the audience have a question? And I take a glass of legacy.
Yes. Yes.
Wait, let me come to you so we can hear it.
Okay. Hello. My question is about how Jesse influenced, how the director influenced I'm a student of theirs. What was sort of the, how did the director influence the play, and what was added that nobody else could have added? All right, that's the end.
I mean, Jesse is just brilliant and is terrific with new plays and has just this incredible open heart and spirit, but also this just like is fiercely smart with this incredible dramaturgical mind. And so for the first go round, I mean, she really was the one that was like just had us keep stripping it back and stripping it back. And she was the one that really landed on, it just needs to be mime, sound, and lights. And I think that is the success of the show, of those three things coming together. And then also just like trusting in that. And then she's also just, we like to dig a lot, the three of us. And so she, you know, just digs deeper of like how many different angles can we find, how many, what layers are we missing, what textures are we missing, and then really coming back into the room this go round, we weren't interested, none of us were interested, and especially Jesse, of like trying to recreate what we did in 2019. It was really like coming back with it with fresh eyes and then looking and being like, okay, we were on such a time crunch before, we were really trying to build the container. Like, we built the container last time, and now it's like, well, we have the container, now we get to like change some of the ingredients that we fill it with. And so Crystal still did work on the script on this time round, cutting things, adding things. And the thing that Jesse really came in with this time around was she was saying that in 2019, although we felt for Jesse, for Jenny, and like we mourned her, we didn't really get a real sense of what their relationship was and a real sense of who she was. And so we just kept digging of like, okay, what are pockets where we can really flesh Jenny out more? And so really all of those scenes were scenes that Crystal added to, or we stripped away if we felt like it wasn't. And so I feel like I think in this production where we really get a sense of who Jenny is more, and so then the loss does feel greater.
There are parts of Kristen's life that come from my family, parts of my family. My mom's side's okay, so we're here. But my dad's side, we're kind of strange from. They do live in Indianapolis. But I have a very healthy relationship with my parents. And Cookie, or whatever. And I think, Jesse, you know, I don't want to speak about her family life without her being here, but I think one has gone through a lot to be as proud and open and such an icon of the LGBTQ community. And so was very vocal about how important this play and story is, and also the parental aspect of that, and how and struggling with parents, you know, and that kind of acceptance. That's something that also got stronger in the play. Is this moment between Kristen and her mom at the end?
And also, Jesse cuts to the quick a lot in terms of just asking very direct but important questions. And so even stepping back into this, I remember the three of us had a Zoom call, and she just said, "I just want to hear out loud, why do we want to do this now?
Yeah.
Why do you, Megan? Why do you, Crystal? Yeah. And I will tell you why I want to." And so then it was just like out loud in the room, and we were all like on the same page. And I thought that was just a really beautiful thing to do.
Something else I'll add is that to have this experience here, as you can see, we have so many beautiful producing partners that have come together to help make this a reality. But I think they also saw our bonded commitment to each other, and we were very committed to each other and kind of almost made our own little group to stay together and make this happen.
Is there another hand up that I see before? Yes. Okay.
Okay, sorry,
No, that's okay.
Okay.
Oh, what's your doggy's name?
His name is Scuttle. I'm sorry that he has been a coffee fit at the very beginning of the show.
He's similar to him.
Hi.
So I'm headed to Edinburgh Fringe in a few weeks. I saw that this show did the Fringe. What was that experience like? What did you learn from that experience? Any advice for anybody going to the Fringe as a potential producer looking for projects? Yeah.
Awesome.
I think all, because also we were there digitally, because we were the pandemic season.
The pandemic.
Yes. Which was a really interesting opportunity, because what happened between that, and then I think there was another streaming thing that was not in a row.
Festivals that couldn't happen because of the pandemic.
And a lot of things, right? We're still talking about it, right? How to involve streaming more, because it suddenly allowed us, for fans and folks globally, in fact, probably that really helped with the Italian tour later. But what I did get from that, and then also a little things from the folks I know, I'm sure Megan has some insight on that too. There was a digital component, but there was also a live component. And so I then was connected with many friends that I made at shows at Soho Playhouse and so forth, even though I was still here. So my community widened even more, and I feel like that is the best thing about it. The one thing I know is if you're doing a show, make sure you have a publicist. That I absolutely know, I can say 120%. Just be there for your other shows and promote yours and be part, you're going to be part of the community. And I think just listen if you're listening as a producer, because it's going to be a real authentic word of mouth experience.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the name of your show, if anybody's going to be here?
Oh, no. So I'm looking for potential projects to bring back here.
Gotcha. Oh, yes. Wonderful.
We got to come back.
I think we have time for one more question. All right, right here.
So in the play, because I saw Kristen get a book published digitally, albeit, so it made me think about the business of plays. So I was curious about, from the point of inception, what was the business of making this, of bringing this to stage? From investors to getting partners, what was that like?
This is actually,
half the time I'm teaching a playwriting class, and then I feel like I realize I'm talking so much about what you just asked.
And I was like, wait, you have to write plays, and then you...
Because I like to talk about how we like to act like it's magic, but it's not magic, but it is magic. But I think the process that I've gone through that my plays are having success with, and Open is one of them, and then I have a Roman World premiere after this with a new play called Rocket Man, is that I stole a little bit from what I was learning in musical theater. So in musical theater, you do a lot of internal workshopping, and a lot of you don't just send out the script. You have people come, listen to some songs, do a little presentation for them. And I realized that what my fellow players were doing was a little bit different. They were sending out the script and praying. And, you know, and multiply that by a gazillion players. And also, something happened over the past 8 years in theater, like where several young teens woke up and they're like, theater's the most important. I don't even want to do TV. Like, I remember talking to one 17-year-old. I was like, well, you know, you may work in TV. She's like, no. I'll leave that. I was like, okay, all right, you know. So that's great. I love theater, but I'm here because I love theater. So I think that that process allowed me to bond and form relationships, very deep relationships. The second thing I'll say is it's not about you. And it's about the play, but it's not about the play. And so if you invest in other people, you have to invest, again, you're looking for people that are in your world, other kinds of work that you want to see in the world, because that helps you. Because if a play like Indecent can happen on Broadway, that helps. That means that a play like this can happen even off Broadway. We all help each other. Or you see a new musical, you know, that's breaking boundaries. That's going to help you, right? Because it, you know, not that you can't write jukebox musicals, but there's someone there to do that. So I'm sure. I don't know if that's anyway. But I think that that kind of inventiveness, when you see in other people, the more you foster in other people, they remember. And when it's like, it really is kind of like It's a Wonderful Life. They'll show up. And so a good example, a direct example, I'll just end with that, is that Midnight Theatricals is run by my friend Asher, who's amazing. And I saw several of his plays. We exchanged scripts. We got to know each other really well. And when I had this opportunity, I also had someone else who believed in me, but I also believed in them and was investing in their work. They got me a grant for $50,000. And then Asher and I were talking, we had an amazing lunch, and then, you know, I got a phone call 3 months later, and he's like, I love the story you told me, let's keep talking. But I was able to have that moment with him because we were there for each other's work. We knew each other's minds and souls, and he's building up Midnight Theatricals as a company, kept building. So you have to, sometimes we're looking to organizations that already exist, but you have to remember it's almost like lateral, like you're looking for the people in this room that you connect with, and you have to look at things that maybe aren't even born yet, or organizations that aren't born. And if you do something good, and you help someone whose work you believe in, it will come back to you. You're building a community. It really is about community. And this play is really built on community. Every single person you see helping this play is built on community. Megan, do you want to add to that? We also have a strong circle of magicians who came together, a lot of private donors, and who believed in us. Crowdfunding is great, but I knew that the expenses were a little large for that, and I wanted the audience to be invested in coming to the show more than investing that way, so I went to a lot of donors to invest privately.
I think also just Crystal's tenaciousness, like she, even in getting the 2019, it was like when we finally got a producing partners for that, it was people that had given us workshops, and she was like, why do you believe in this enough to give us a workshop but not a production, you know? And so we ended up getting a production and it ended up being like a huge success for that theater company. And then, you know, the pandemic hit, so that the kind of momentum we had going paused, and Crystal was just like, I think it is also just believing in your ideas and the stories you tell. If you really believe in it and keep pursuing it, and know that it's good, like, that just keep going for it. And Crystal was like, we should be telling this story still. And so she just kept knocking on doors. And it's very inspiring.
Right. Well, we do have to wrap things up, so I just want to thank, first of all, everybody here tonight for coming to open and for the podcast and for being here. And thank you for the great questions. Appreciate them. And Crystal, Megan, thank you for staying after the show and doing this comeback with us.
Thank you for asking.
Oh, you're welcome. No problem. And thank you for filming Lou and Eduardo. Eduardo, you are thank you for everything.
Yes.
And I think. Is Sydney up there still? Thank you, everybody.
And don't forget to tell your friends and visit the Step
on
Repeat
if you haven't already. Tweet us. We love it. See ya.
Oh, and your books. Adam, your books.
Oh, yeah. And I am selling copies of my books. So if you want to purchase a copy and get an autograph, I will be out there momentarily.